Sir, 1 minute.
Honourable Sal.
Chair, it's always very unsatisfactory to pretend that your question isn't responded to properly. There's no real way that you can follow.
No, that's fine. That's the nature of politics. There's a proposal to take all the questions and a follow-up. My own proposal was everybody has a priority question. And then you'll be able to ask a follow-up on your priority question. Is that okay? Yeah? No, we were testing the waters, so... You know, what we are saying is one question and one follow-up. No, but hold on, for members. Let's finish this one first. Are we agreeing one question? No, it's fine.
Thanks, Chair. I'm opposed to us having to ask one question as a priority question. That will deprive us, generally. What I'm suggesting is that we take all the questions, because some of the questions are repeating itself. They ask the same question in different English. Then they will now know that this one was asked in this format, and when they answer comprehensively, because we can't have one question, we have several questions.
Okay. No, that's fine. We'll take the several questions, but we will still afford every other member a follow-up. Fine. We'll play it that way. You'll take all the questions. We'll give them a second bite in terms of asking a question if you've not answered their question satisfactorily. All right. It's 10:20 past. I'll start looking at you. This will be an indication that your 30 minutes are over, but if you need more time, we will afford you more time. But if you could do it within the 30 minutes, it will be helpful for us. Okay. Prof, maybe you'll introduce your team. We've indicated you are from Wits University. I've indicated that your presentations are here and members have engaged with them. Members will find them. I'm not sure which number four, I think it is. Cindy's whispering in my ears. Number four for honourable members who've got the files we've given you. And you should have read it by now. Can I then hand over to you, sir, to introduce your team and to keep start from there, and at 20 past, I'll start looking at it. All members have got the presentations, have you? Number 13. Oh, it's under number 13, not number 4. Under number 13. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honourable members, for giving us this opportunity to share our work with you. My name is Mbongiseni Buthelezi. I'm Head of Research at the Public Affairs Research Institute. Next to me, on my left, is the lead researcher on this work, Dr. Christopher Naova, and to my right is Mr. Ryan Brunette, who has also done a lot of work in this area. My role really is just to give a brief background to what the Public Affairs Research Institute is, and then I'll hand over to Dr. Naova, who's our lead researcher. PARI, as we are commonly known, is an academic institute. We're attached both to Wits University and to the University of Cape Town. What we do is we undertake research and policy development in relation to public administration and state institutions. Our approach is multidisciplinary, evidence-based, and collaborative. And one of the things we insist on is being critical and independent. We have pioneered the field of what is called institutional studies in South Africa, through which we undertake some of the leading research work on the nature and the functioning of the South African state. And just to end off, I think this work that this committee is undertaking is extremely timely, and it comes at a time when the question of the fusion of parties and states, not just in South Africa but in a number of countries, is at the forefront of public discussion. I'd like to suggest as a starting point that the thinking and reform of party political funding is essential, but it needs to be a part of a larger basket of reform in South Africa, and part of that reform involves the reform of state institutions. In the previous discussion with Advocate Pinar, the chair referred particularly to the question of tender. and the way which senators are used to punish people who are either donating or not donating to political parties. And Advocate Pinar suggests that there's a lot of reform that needs to be done in the tendering system. We think that there's a lot more reform that needs to be done, including the funding of political parties, but extending much further into how state institutions function. And with that, thank you. May I turn over to Dr. Alder.
Thank you, Mbongiseni, and very good morning, Chairperson and Honourable Members. It's some years since I've been in this House. some of you will recall, in fact, there were a number of faces here that I recall from when I had to come and account here as Director General for the Department of Environment and Tourism. So it's a pleasure to be back and to make the connections again, albeit in a very different capacity this time. So I'm going to summarize the conclusions in our paper, and I'm going to split them into two areas. The one is on the public funding of political parties, and then I'll come to the private funding and the use of state resources. So on the issue of public funding, South Africa really stands head to head with its peers in that it has a well-developed system of public funding with, as members I think are already well familiar, three principal sources. So there's the represented political parties fund, which is allocated on the basis of proportionality, that's 90% of the fund, and equity, which is 10% of the funds. The latest budget figures indicate there's about 133 million in the last financial year that went through that fund. Then there's Parliament's political party allowances, and that supports parties to perform a range of functions, including support to political parties functioning, support to constituencies and constituency allowances, and support to the leadership, particularly the leader of the party. There's considerably more that goes through that on an annual basis. The last financial year, about 395 million went out through that mechanism. Then, in addition, the provincial legislatures have similar laws dealing with parliamentary and other allowances. And, in fact, that's where the bulk of the money goes. In the last financial year, about 627 million. So, in all, a fairly considerable chunk of money, about 1.15 billion rands, was given in public funding to political parties for various functions. This is not all campaigning, so I wouldn't assume that it's just for election campaigns. I mean, some of it performs functions that are integral to the running of Parliament and to the running of constituency offices, etc. But in one way or another, it's supporting the parties. Now, there are good arguments for public funding, not least because of the financial security that public funding brings. It lowers the level that of influence private interests can exert, and particularly large corporate interests, which is really the big area of concern that we all have. But there is a counterbalancing force, and that is that by raising and accounting for funds, there's a level of, there's a level of public accountability that parties are forced to go through. If you completely removing the obligation for fundraising, from political parties is not in the interests of democracy. Surveying the international landscape, the majority of countries, so there was this Money, Politics and Transparency survey that the previous speaker mentioned. So there were 54 countries in that sample. These are a spread of developed and developing countries around the world. 39 out of 54 have systems of direct funding for political parties. And 37 of those 54 have legally defined transparent and equitable allocation mechanisms. So there's, you know, the overwhelming international experience supports this mechanism. So Perry's recommendation on this side, we believe that the principle of public funding is well established. We recommend that the country continues to build on the existing system and that it increases the quantum of funds that are made available through the public mechanism. And that increase in the quantum, you see later why it counterbalances the other measures that we are proposing. We do suggest that this is complemented by market-based mechanisms and incentives. And in particular, we suggest that attention is paid to the tax treatment of donations. Currently, donations to the political, to all political parties do not qualify as tax exempt, and they attract donations of tax which the donor is ultimately liable for. In our opinion, tax exemption will incentivize private donations, and it will have the added benefit of building transparency into the party funding system. Because in order to qualify for the tax exemption, both the donor and the recipient would be obliged to report it to the South African Revenue Services. So that would create a dual system of reporting and accounting for those funds. We've looked broadly at the existing formula. I have to say this is not Perry's particular area of research speciality, but our opinion is that the formula seems to be working well, and we don't have particular recommendations for its amendment. On the area of private funding, South Africa is a laggard internationally. In fact, we have an almost entirely unregulated system. So parties are not required to disclose who funds them. Donations to parties don't have to be reported or disclosed. In-kind donations don't need to be reported or disclosed. There's no treatment of third-party fundraising efforts. There are no limits on cash donations. Anonymous donations, there are no limits on loans, there's no limit on the amount that can be contributed, nor on overseas contributions, and parties are not constrained in terms of what amounts they can spend. as we note quite extensively in the report, in the absence of regulations, large corporates and wealthy individuals are able to translate their financial muscle into political power by entering into exchanges. And we have documented those exchanges in a number of instances in the work that we do. And we do need to note that they're not confined to any one particular party. So we've observed incidents of exchanges in a number of political configurations where other parties are in power or in coalition-type governments. We we've also noted that many political parties receive very substantial contributions from foreign interests. We've put a bit of the detail into the report. And then looking at the international experience of the 54 countries I mentioned earlier, so there are 14 countries that place a maximum limit on what corporations can contribute. In another 24, corporate donations are either completely banned or they're restricted to only political parties or candidates. 25 countries restrict the amount that individuals can donate. 35 countries restrict or limit anonymous contributions. 47 countries require in-kind donations to be reported. 35 countries require all donations to be reported. The remainder require donations over a certain threshold. There are 4 countries that ban cash donations, 17 more allow them under a specific threshold, and 23 countries require loans to parties to be disclosed. So there's a large body of international experience that places restrictions on various components of private funding of parties. Our recommendation is that this committee considers a mix of those measures, and in particular we are recommending firstly an annually adjusted cap on contributions from private individuals and corporations, and that cap should include in-kind donations and loans. In other words, in-kind donations and loans should be treated in the same way as other contributions. Secondly, we recommend a ban on anonymous donations and cash donations above a certain threshold, and we would recommend that threshold is set at a fairly low level. We also support restrictions being placed on foreign contributions, either to limit the amount that can be received, so again to a fairly low amount, or to exclude them outright. And lastly, we would recommend that the definition of political party be explicitly phrased to include third-party fundraising vehicles. Then on the use of state resources, So we note in our report that the Electoral Act and the code in terms of that act don't explicitly prohibit the use of state resources to influence election outcomes, although they do have other provisions. So they prohibit undue influence and intimidation, and they prohibit offering any inducement or reward to vote for or join a party. The Public Service Act does have a code of conduct that applies to public servants, and it obliges them to adhere to certain basic values and principles which prohibit partisan behavior, overtly partisan behavior. The Public Service Commission is charged with enforcing the code, although we note that in practice they've got very limited capacity. And then, of course, national and provincial political leaders have to adhere to the code of ethics for members of the executive, and that code prohibits them from exposing themselves to any conflict of interest situations and from using their position to enrich themselves or to improperly benefit others, and others includes political parties. So there are some restrictions placed on the code of ethics for members. And then, as you're aware, the public protector is charged with investigating and prescribing sanctions. As mentioned earlier, I mean, there have been a number of instances of abuse. These were quite well documented around the 2014 national and provincial elections, and this included not just the use of food parcels, but also economic intimidation where voters were threatened with the loss of grants and the denial of jobs. Also, opposition parties were denied access to and use of certain facilities, public venues, stadiums, etc. The public protector even investigated the SASA event. This was involving the then head of the ANC Youth League, Julius Malema, and found that it constituted improper conduct. We've looked at the international experience. In fact, I have to say, disturbingly, these kinds of practices are very widespread internationally. They're deleterious to democracy, but in 51 out of the 54 countries surveyed, non-financial state resources such as buildings, vehicles, staff, and other things are directed towards political ends. And there were only three countries, Austria, the UK, and Sweden, that avoided this outright. So it's a widespread phenomenon, and I think it has to be included in the deliberations of this committee. So our recommendation is that the regulatory framework is tightened up around these practices, and in particular, we suggest that the Electoral Act is amended to explicitly prohibit the use of state resources to influence election outcomes, and that should include the involvement of public servants in any official capacity in political campaigns, the use of state resources at party political events, and the accelerated rollout of state programs immediately before an election. We also suggest that the code of conduct for public servants is strengthened to prohibit public servants from using their office to campaign for or in any way to support political parties. And this should be a disciplinary offence. And then measures to boost the capacity of the Public Service Commission need to be looked at. Then on reporting, Chair, we're aware that part of the issue this committee is looking at is both the reporting and the disclosure, and I'm going to deal with the two separately. So firstly, on the reporting, out of the 54 countries that were surveyed, 83% require their parties or candidates to submit financial reports that include information on contributions and expenditures annually. So there's the body of international practice favors obligatory reporting. And even within our peer group of countries in BRICS, excluding China, which is essentially a one-party system, but other than China, South Africa stands alone in not having provisions around transparency of party political funding. So we support, as Parry, the extension of reporting requirements for political parties to account for all private monies allocated. We suggest that this is achieved by extending the remit of the Public Funding of Represented Political Parties Act to cover private sources. And the Act establishes a framework for distribution, use, reporting, and accountability, which is done under the supervision of the IEC. We recommend that outside of election periods, annual reporting of party donations is sufficient as a starting point, but during election periods, more frequent reporting on at least a quarterly and possibly even a monthly basis should be implemented. On the transparency side, Chair, the information that's currently reported to the IEC on the public funding is made available on request, and it does appear eventually in the annual report, which is, of course, tabled after the fact, some months after the fact. But in here, it's very difficult to get access to that information. It's possible, but you've got to put quite a lot of effort into requesting this information from the IEC. Of the international survey, a number of countries, 21 countries have laws that mandate that this is all reported. 24 require financial reports to be made publicly accessible. So our view is that we support the automatic publishing of party financing data, and that, of course, must be backed up by its auditing by the Auditor General. Then on enforcement, enforcement is a global problem. So fewer than half of the countries that were surveyed carried out three or more investigations into political finance issues during the most recent campaigns. And of the oversight authorities that did investigations, only seven published the results of those investigations. Our view is that if you're going to have a capacity to enforce party funding, it's got to be politically independent. There are risks around locating this in both SARS or the IEC, as it's not part of their core mandate. And we consider it that it constitutes a political risk to their other core functions. So our suggestion is that this committee considers the establishment of a separate, dedicated capacity, independently controlled, to monitor, to receive complaints, and to investigate campaigns to ensure that there's compliance with party funding prescripts. Then, Chair, we want to just make a quick comment on the fractional use of funds. So, South Africa's had a rise of fractional behavior within political parties. Because it's the majority party nationally and in eight of the nine provinces, of course, the ANC has been the particular subject, a lot of this, factional behavior, but similar patterns are observed in other parties in power, and we believe it's also a fairly widespread phenomenon. It's not a phenomenon germane to any particular party. And it's fueled by the kinds of money, particularly private money, that gets channeled into electoral contests within parties. So we believe that this committee needs to also apply its mind to contests over power within political parties. And our specific suggestion is that in tightening up regulation in this area, the definition of political party should be extended to include leaders or groups within the party campaigning for political office in that party. Then, lastly, Chair, we'd like to make a submission on policy institutes. So, alongside the increase in public and private funding for political parties, our suggestion is that a certain proportion of those funds are earmarked for public policy and research purposes. And our argument is that this is in the interests of sound and stable governance. By building the capacity of parties to have sound public policy for governance and for public administration, it will promote a level of policy literacy and readiness to govern, which gets carried into government by whatever party wins the political contest. And we're suggesting this, something along the lines of the German mechanism, where, for instance, you've got the Konrad Adenauer Foundation and the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung, which are German political foundations associated respectively with the CDU and the Social Democratic Party. Which has provided a level of policy input and research into those parties. So we recommend that public funding should seek to incentivize the establishment of policy institutes that are attached to but independent of the political parties represented in Parliament. In closing, Chair, we do want to just make another suggestion for your consideration around deepening democracy, which I'm going to ask my colleague Ryan to talk to. It's one slide. I know you're looking at me as if the time is up. So one slide, Ryan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, honourable members. I won't take too much time, I think. In general, looking at party finance reform episodes in other countries, these generally don't exceed expectations. There's all sorts of hindrances that they experience. It's also generally the case that party finance reform sits at some distance to ordinary citizens. It's difficult to make the link regarding how it affects their lives. I don't think that needs to be the case. I think that there are options available for using party finance reform in a way that can substantially deepen democracy and other values that we hold dear. The model that I'm suggesting today is developed in the United States and in response to a very particular problem. In the United States, an attempt at party finance reform was effectively blocked by the Supreme Court on the grounds that it restricted the kind of right to financial association of ordinary members of the public. Now, arguably, that's also a feature of our constitution, which would have to be engaged with, which is, you know, what is the constitutionality of this bill that might be developed in this process. Now, this led to kind of rethinking of the model, and what I'm presenting now is a kind of live model in the United States situation, in the United States debates. It not only gets around that particular constitutional provision, but it also gets around certain other kind of limits to democratic practice around the world. And the particular limit that it gets around is really the kind of distance between kind of norms of democratic control and the kind of practical demands of government formation. So as we all know, it takes around 4 or 5 years for governments to kind of get settled in to form, to begin to drive a program. In countries where governments are formed every year or so for particular reasons to those countries, where governments are formed every year, really power shifts to the bureaucracy, as it occurred in Italy in their post-war experience. So generally, as we know, 4 or 5 years is the norm for elections. And this really means that ordinary citizens can only be involved in the democratic process every 4 or 5 years in South Africa, every 5 years, of course. The model of what we're calling, what the Americans call democracy cards, right, allows the system to kind of reach around that particular problem. Right? And it really achieves this by providing a distinct mechanism for allocating public funding of political parties. And the concept is really simple. It's really that every registered voter, or we can use it in another category, gets a particular sum of money. So if we were to kind of guesstimate the amount of money that political parties use in South Africa, that would probably be around 100 or 75 rand a year. And this could be allocated yearly, or could be allocated quarterly. But effectively, they would receive this sum of money, and then they could expend the sum of money on the party of their choice. So there'd be a kind of defined list of institutions that they could shift this money towards. Now that's the basic mechanism. Now of course, you know, there's, I mean, I think it is entirely kind of technologically achievable in the South African situation at relatively limited cost. It could build on the systems that are available in banks and in the South African Social Security Agency. And, you know, we can have a discussion around the kind of design of the system in concrete terms. But I think for now what's important is to kind of just put across the principle, and to put across the principle in a way that's, you know, that this is achievable. It's not a utopian idea. And effectively what it provides is a more regular and a more robust linkage between parties and voters. Now, in terms of design, you know, lots of work has already been done in the United States situation. There's model legislation that could be kind of drawn on by this committee, by this House. It hasn't been implemented anywhere. And I think that's an argument in its favor, because where South Africa would be going would be kind of globally pioneering. We'd be going beyond what other countries have done. It also speaks to kind of a range of issues in party finance reform that we've kind of I've seen raised in this committee. Concerns around the funding of opposition parties, for example. This kind of reaches around those concerns as well. Ordinary voters would not be penalised for how they distribute their money. Yeah, and I think I'll leave it there.
Good. Thank you, Chair. That ends our presentation, and we look forward to the engagement.
Thank you very much, Prof. Alva. As agreed to, we are going to open up for questions. You'll have to note your questions, because we've agreed you're going to ask all the questions before they respond. Similarly, you will note the questions asked, and members will then be given a second bite if they feel they want a follow-up question. So, all the questions, yeah. And that's what I'm saying, for me, it's just not practical, because the problem I have if we say all the questions, if the person asks 20 questions, it then distorts it, but we will try it in that fashion. Whatever question you have to ask them, you'll note them, and then we will take responses and second bite if there's a need for second bite. So can I have an indication of those that would like to raise questions? Prof. Kubisa, and then Ntanta, a little bit. And then Matthijs, and then Sal, followed by Bongo, followed by Singh, followed by Maseko. In that order.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yeah, now I just wanted to find out whether it's possible to deal with issues of funds that may come to individuals or parties clandestinely, because I believe that in spite of regulating the whole issue, what if somebody were to come behind and say, this is what I'm giving you, this is $1 million, you go and do your campaign. How would you know if somebody were just to keep quiet? Do you think it's possible to ensure that everything is reported? Then the second one, Chairperson, which is the last one, is the issue of restricting on campaigns, funding for campaigns, you know, psychologically. The belief is that campaigns is what give us members of parliament. And that is a fact. Therefore, the belief is that material financial resources should get into campaigns over and above ongoing effects of democracy, etc. But campaigns supersede everything, because it's a time where if you've got resources, you've got to go out there and ensure that you get more members. And if you restrict as per your recommendations, will that not tamper with democracy as such? Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, my first question is with regards to factions in political parties. You were specific when you were talking about factions in the ANC, but I'm not sure where does it fit in terms of us regulating party funding. If you can explain, why are you talking about factions in the ANC specifically? Because I thought maybe what was going to be interest for me, especially from your side, is foreign government supporting other political parties in our country to destabilize government. So that's where my interest is. But why do you think they must not be regulated, if I heard you well? But also my interest is with regards to in-kind donations. I'm sure my little understanding with in-kind donations, I'm not sure whether you were saying we must accept it or we must not accept it, or you were saying we must not regulate. Can you just define what do you mean by in-kind donation? So that, you know, I cannot misquote you. Regarding fundraising in promoting democracies, can you also elaborate on that one? Whether is it correct for political parties to do fundraising or it's not? And if you say yes, it's correct that political parties can do fundraising, how then do we regulate that? I think the other point that I wanted to hear from you is regarding foundations. You know that there are many foundations, for example, Helen Suzman Foundation. What do you think, in your own view, how then do we regulate foundations? Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Honourable Matthijs.
Thank you, Chairperson. You alluded that there should be, well, you didn't allude, but you indicated that we should increase funding from the state to political parties. Why? What research do you have? Is there some ballpark figure that you think should be a reasonable amount? And I ask this question in light of the current state of our country, the amount of looting that is going on, the amount of money that is going unaccounted for. So I'd like you to speak to that. Number two, you also indicate that the proportional allocation that we have now, which is 90%, 10%, is working. Is it working because we just make it work, or what research or what information do you have that speaks to how this is actually strengthening our democracy? Number three, the regulator. So you spoke quite a lot regarding how we must regulate this public funding. Is it possible that we look at a model of actually just capacity? We've got the electoral court, right? So is there an option, or can we look at maybe strengthening or giving more powers to the electoral court to become that regulating body? Do you have any information or research regarding the powers this regulator should have? You know, many times we set up commissions and we have various regulatories and they don't have any power to do anything. They just issue a report and it'll stay dangling around for many years to come. So what can we do in terms of giving it powers to actually prosecute and let there be some penalties regarding that? Otherwise, it's just a waste of time. We're just going to have another body that's not doing anything. The recommendation, I think it's number 8, about perhaps giving voters money. I think the majority of our voters live in dire levels of poverty. So it would be like giving them money to, I don't know. I think it'll probably work, or it could work in a more advanced economy where we don't have such high levels of dire poverty that we have here. And also just asking for more funding, or asking voters to be able to do that when they see the state of what is already allocated for them to receive basic services, and they don't do that. So I'd like you just to speak to that, on how we will be able to, you know, bridge that gap. I think it would be quite a slap in the face to give a donor, like, even if it's, a voter 200 rand when they don't have bread on their plate, and say, okay, go and give it to your political party of your choice, when they know that government is looting money and can't even deliver them toilets. So I'd just like you to speak to that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Then it will be Honourable Self, followed by Bongo, followed by Singh, and followed by Maseko.
Thank you very much, Chair. I was intrigued by the concept of economic intimidation, which appeared in the paper. And the paper dealt with one form of it, or several forms of it, relating to how it impacts on voters. But it also can be used to impact on donors. And the circumstance most usually quoted is the fear of losing government business, for the point that you raised earlier about that. But that's not the only type of intimidation. Because we have a civil service that's characterized by cadre deployment, there's also a legitimate or illegitimate, doesn't matter, fear on the part of donors that they will be targeted, for example, by inspections from the Labour Department, or inspections from SARS, or they'll, in generally speaking, be disadvantaged if it became known that they gave money to a particular political party. Now, how does one get around that? I mean, it's all very well to say, well, you know, just disclose, because, you know, that's what we have to do. But how is one going to protect donors' bona fide interests in circumstances like that? Secondly, I was also intrigued by the idea of a new institution outside of the IEC to enforce this regime. Well, I think we all need to accept that to police this or to enforce it is going to require a lot of resources. And I agree that the Electoral Commission probably doesn't have the resources or the expertise to do it. I mean, they can't even deliver an addressed voter roll. But it's precisely the point when we are moving in Parliament gradually towards reducing the number of Chapter 9 institutions, consolidating their functions, we're now faced with a proposal to in fact increase the number or add another one. So just perhaps some comments on that. And finally, I'd be interested to know what one does about, if you like, rogue units. Because there was a story that the rounds in the last election, that there was a black ops office that was set up, if you like, as an undercover agency to promote disinformation. And whether the presenters have any idea about how to stop that particular abuse. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Bongo.
Yeah, thank you very much, and thanks for the presentation. With regard to the presentation, if I can start with recommendation number 6. I just want to know what informs this recommendation number 6, because in my view, campaigns and the other things that goes with campaign are the issues that in the main give you more votes. So that restriction, I just want to know what informs that restriction. Recommendation number 7. I think it also talks to what you said, there must be a regulatory body is your view in view of the fact that the fiscals are not enough in dealing with the funds themselves, but secondly, establishing other institutions when the IEC and SARS are there. But what strikes me the most in the whole presentation, like just like Honorable Ndaba has raised, number five in your presentation. I don't know what informs this number five, because you're making reference of one political party, and as though I thought I'm a member of that party, or because once you make reference of a party, you must make reference of all other parties in terms of their view around these issues. To me, state resources vis-a-vis non-disclosure, because from where I'm sitting, I think we're speaking of the formula, and we are saying the formula must not change. I want you to comment on the formula that must not change vis-a-vis the increase that you are proposing, and in line with what you said, that some of the things must not be disclosed. Because it's either you change the formula, then you ban other things, and as you ban other things, I want you to give us your suggestions, not at a general level, your suggestion in terms of what you think the threshold must be, a threshold, your suggestion in terms of what you think is the amount, given the research you have made, so that when you take a decision, we will know that we are comparing research from various institutions, so that we make up our mind properly. So I want you to comment on that. Thanks.
Thank you, Bob. Honorable Singh, and then followed by Honorable Osek.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and I'd really like to thank the presenters for a very objective presentation. Chairperson, there was this concept, but I heard the word once from Dr. Oliver, of loans. Now, I do know that, because I can speak for myself and my party, that we have gone to financial institutions in the past to get loans. But it has become increasingly difficult for, you know, these institutions to provide loans. So I'd just like you to expand on possibly the need. You cannot compel a financial institution to give you a loan because it's subject to the affordability and your ability to pay, etc. But what if a political party gets a loan from company X and they cite it as a loan payable over 5 years? How do we prevent that kind of thing happening? The financial institutions obviously will have to disclose a loan that's been given to a political party. And then we've been having a discussion in the committee as we had our first meeting about which are political parties. And then we decided that we look at the constitution. These are political parties represented in parliament. Now, there are hundreds of political parties, maybe an exaggeration, but a number of them, maybe five or six times more than those represented in parliament that also contest elections. Where do we fit them into this? The whole idea of party political funding. And then the other aspect I'd like to comment on is donations that we receive as political parties and the source of that funding. Because, you know, in other countries in the world, you hear of sources of funding from illegitimate means through drug sales and all other kind of things that happen. And they contribute to political parties. How do we bring that in? And then lastly is, you know, we've been thinking about this, that here we sit as politicians representing political parties, and we are trying to convince the public out there, who are the taxpayers, that, hey, we need more money. Now, what is the sound justification? you bring in one example, which I'd like you to expand on, research and development of policy research. You can just talk about that, because it's very difficult to ask for money, somebody else's money, for you to spend. And I mean us to spend. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable President.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Thank you for the presentation. I just want to also raise the issue of point 5, which I think it's misplaced in the presentation on the factions that are spoken about. And then also the funding, the public funding that would then be given to political parties. Also, you say they must also deal with the issue of promotion of democracy and so forth. I would think in one part of promoting democracy, for instance, is the public education. For instance, on how to register or the importance of voting. So it should then be this from this fund that it should be for such education. Shouldn't that be the responsibility of the IEC as an independent body to educate the public on the importance of voting, other than being party A seen as campaigning when it is actually trying to educate the public, genuinely so, to register and vote, and why is it important to vote. And I think also the issue of the loans, I think that they should be prohibited, but also what informs that. Because parties have got the right, if they want to have a loan, if they want to buy a building, and if the relationship between the funding or the funding institution and that political party, of which a bank or whatever, if they don't comply on certain issues, they will not grant that party the loan that they require. And lastly, on the individual members within parties campaigning, receiving private funding to campaign for a party position, but not the money not going to the party, but to the individual, whereas the campaign is for a position within the party. Your views on that?
Thank you very much. No other takers? Done? Okay, let me take the opportunity to ask two or three questions. The first one, I think, like Honorable Matthijs, I can't see how the suggestion of giving South Africans an extra 100 rand per annum and saying to them, take that money and fund political parties when they don't have bread on the table, will work in South Africa currently. I accept the intention that you want them to be actively involved, but I think the reality right now would make it really difficult for us to do that. So I thought that was the first one. You know, the second point, Prof. Oliver, you indicated that of the 1.1 billion rand that currently goes to political parties from various sources, more than 50% comes from the provincial sphere. And there's an argument that has been made by the previous presenter about the legality of that exercise. I wonder what is your take? If 50% is coming from provincial government, and there's a quid, not legality, the constitutionality of it. If 50% is coming from that sphere, what's your view on the constitutionality having heard that the previous speaker said he or that old constitution thinks that it's not constitutional. The other point that I think you're skirting around, not skirting around, but you're not assisting us in, all of you that have spoken so far, is you indicate that there must be enforceability. Whether it's the IEC or an independent body, it's not the issue. But you're not telling us what the penalties, and I'm saying this so that those that come after you must think about it. What is the penalty? Somebody deliberately breaks the law. Do we ban him from participating in the next election? So it's one thing to say enforceability, but you should be able to say these are the kinds of deterrents to that thing. So, and then the final one, you know, the you spoke about donations in kind, using state resources, whether it be cars or human bodies and so on, and restrictions, who should and who shouldn't fund political parties. Nobody is telling us thus far anyway, and I would have expected the two of you as academic institutions or research bodies to have said this to us. Corporate organizations that do business with the state, what is your view on them funding or otherwise of political parties? In other words, 90% of my business is, I don't know, supplying milk to a certain school, get that from government. Should I be able to fund a political party, fund an individual in the ward? Organizations doing business with the state, should they or should they not be banned, or how do you regulate them, or should they be regulated? Because it could be used as a conduit. So if you could talk to those points for us, and then we'll offer members a second bite if they need a second bite of clarity on their questions. Is there anybody else before we allow you that wants to put a question that has not spoken thus far? No? Honourable Kumede?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson. I think the proposals have also to indicate as to whether the power dynamics in society, which side does it move? For instance, if private contribution normally favors the middle class communities, and then the government or public funds should cater for the working class, but there should be a how mechanism. And I do not find that in your contribution as learned researchers. Perhaps if you could get into the dynamic as well. I do not know whether you understand me well. There is the interest of the working class parties that is normally not catered for by the corporate world. What do you say on that?
Right. Decision time. The boss is whispering in my ear that we're close to lunch. The question is, and I don't know your availability, do we break now and take questions later, or do we give them half an hour to field our questions and then break, looking at the side of the house? Complete. So you've got until 1:30 to complete for us, and then we'll take our break at 1:30. Is that okay? And once again to our colleagues from I think it's right to know, our apologies, but we're playing it. Because of our sins, we'll provide finger lunch for you outside as well. You'll be welcome to our finger lunch, everybody that's here. You've got exactly half an hour, 25 past one, we will wrap it up. Over to you. Oh, not 25 past one. In fact, sooner, 25 past one, we'll wrap it up, even including follow-up questions.
Yeah.
So if we all can be economical, by 25 plus 1 we'll be done with the session. Over to you, sir.
So, Chair, maybe if I could respond a little bit flexibly and start with Honourable Gumede's point, because I think it sets the context for what we are proposing. The broad objective that informs our submission is to decrease the influence of private interests on the state, and in particular to prevent the leveraging of state power in order to fund parties. That's the primary thrust of our suggestions. And by decreasing the influence of corporate interests, we're obviously counterbalancing that by increasing the interests of the poor and the working class. Everyone that's outside of capital, organized capital, monopoly capital. Our view, and this cuts to two of the questions, I mean, we think political campaigning is important for democracy. We're not trying to argue that political campaigning should not take place or should be downplayed or restricted in any way. In fact, the broad thrust of our argument is that the aggregate quantum of money that's going into party political campaigns should remain the same. We don't think it should. So if you combine public and private sources, the aggregate quantum should remain the same. And I think in ultimately making the decisions that this committee is going to have to make, it would be useful to do a bit of modeling around that. So, ultimately you want to make sure that the balance of measures, the public funding, the tax incentives, and the restrictions on private funding, you know, you need to be able to work out how does that all balance and what's the final amount that you're going to end up with. Now, the problem, we know very specifically how much public money goes into the system. The problem is that we don't know how much private money goes in, because no party, as we currently stand, discloses it. There are indirect calculations and estimates. So, for instance, one of the academics, Butler, estimated that in 1999 there was 53 million of public money. In fact, that we know that there was 53 million, and there was between 300 and 500 million of private money. In 2009, there was 80 million of public money and about 500 million of private money. We don't have an accurate estimate of 2014 or the 2016 local government elections. But if you ask me to put a figure, let's say it's roughly a billion in the last national and provincial election, which would in aggregate quantum mean that you have 1 billion plus 1 billion, 2 billion rands going into political parties and campaigns. But that's a thumbsuck estimate. There's no, that's not a scientific estimate. And I would argue that you want to, in rough terms, keep that overall quantum the same, because there are public benefits from campaigning. It's about getting a message out to people, enabling voters to hear that message and make a decision about different parties, and ultimately, elect a government that represents their interests. So, those are public benefits, and I think it's money well spent. We're not arguing that the aggregate quantum should be decreased. What we are suggesting is that the public quantum should be increased, and the private side should be more regulated, more restrictions, both on amounts, reporting, disclosure. Plus, we're suggesting a tax incentive to slightly offset that regulation on the private side. We're suggesting a tax incentive which also encourages the reporting and the disclosure. So we think combined, if you combine increasing public, restricting private, putting the tax incentive in place, you can retain the overall aggregate quantum into the parties of about 2 billion. So I hope that broadly clarifies what our intention is. And then if I can just go into some of the specific questions. So Prof asked about the clandestine sources and how they can be dealt with. And obviously, if we make all contributions reportable and disclosable, by extension, those can be audited by the Auditor General, and the Auditor General will be able to detect whether there are illicit or clandestine sources. And that should be a fairly strong check and balance in the system. It's not completely foolproof, but in broad terms, it's a pretty strong mechanism. In terms of restricting the amount parties can spend on campaigns, we've not gone that route in the recommendations we've made. We've focused on restricting the sources. I know there are some arguments about restricting the aggregate amount a party can spend, but we believe it amounts to, it's not an area that we felt particularly warranted restriction. But I know that there are a number of stakeholders that will argue with you that that's something that should be done. Our view is that in broad terms, the amount that's spent on political campaigns is not the problem. It's not the amount that's spent on the campaign. It's the way that the funding is sourced. Honourable Ndaba, with respect to factions in parties, maybe I should just make this absolutely clear. Where we've mentioned the ANC in the document, we've tried to indicate quite clearly that the phenomena we are describing, we have observed in all parties. So we've documented instances in which the DA, the UDM, the IFP, and others have also used state resources. We're not trying to throw anything at any particular party. We believe what we've observed indicates that there are widespread, pervasive phenomena of use of state resources and of factionalism in parties. And the point we're making is that only restricting the donations to parties per se and not to leaders contesting for position in parties is going to leave a whole unregulated area. Because it's the same problem. It's leaders and parties doing deals in the state in order to fund their campaigns. So if you restrict what parties can raise, but you don't restrict what individuals campaigning for office in a party can do or raise. You're creating a huge loophole, which is going to then give rise to a whole set of other problems. So we're not raising factionalism to try and embarrass any particular party here. We've observed factional behavior in many parties. Because it's the majority party in national, the ANC attracts particular attention, and that just comes with being the majority party. So I hope that clarifies our stance here. We're not being partisan. We look at all parties equally, and our interest is in the way that these behaviors impact on the state and on state capacity. Honorable Ndaba spoke about foreign government sources. Our view is that those should be either banned outright or a cap put on it that is very restrictive. And if you want me to put a figure on it, I'd say 10,000 rand. That could go either way. I mean, our view is that you should not be allowing any substantial foreign influence in the politics of the country. So there's strong merit to ban foreign donations outright. Our suggestion on in-kind donations is that you treat them like any other donations. So an in-kind donation would be, for instance, I donate T-shirts to you. You can buy those T-shirts at 27 rand a T-shirt. And instead of giving you the money to buy the T-shirts, I buy the T-shirts and I give you the T-shirts. That's the in-kind donation. The value of that in-kind donation is the number of T-shirts times 27 rand. It should be treated as if I've paid you the money. There should be no difference in the way that in-kind is treated versus cash or monetary value donations. In terms of fundraising, we believe it is correct to fundraise. So we're not arguing that all fundraising should cease and that the money should just come through the public side. We think fundraising is a healthy part of political activity, and going out and raising money from your members and supporters is part of what political parties do. And that should continue. So our intention would not be to stop that kind of activity. In terms of foundations, this is basically a definitional issue in the legislation. So the issue of foundations arises because a lot of parties use, it's particularly common in the American system where they're trying to get around funding laws. So they use super PACs and various independent institutes and bodies to raise money, and those separate bodies go out and then campaign on your behalf. Now, effectively, that's the same thing as giving money to a party. So our view is that third-party agencies or institutes that are actively campaigning on behalf of a political party need to be treated in the same way as if it's a donation to that political party. So in the definition of political party, we recommend that you expand to include third-party agents campaigning on behalf of that party. With respect to the Honourable Matthijs, I think I've answered the issue on public funding and whether it should be increased. You've asked a question around the proportional allocation and whether it's working. Yes, the straightforward answer is that yes, it is working. It's allocated on the basis of representation in the National Assembly, and that's an easily definable and measurable thing. And the allocations that are made from the fund are in direct correspondence to that, and everyone can test that. You get the accounts annually, you can see that that's the basis for the allocations. The 10%, which is the equitable allocation, is then allocated to two provinces for according and through the provinces to parties on the basis of whether they're represented in that provincial parliament or not. And then it's divided equitably amongst the parties in that provincial parliament. Now, that's a fairly well-established mechanism as well. From what we can see, that mechanism has been working. What you could, if you want to add an additional mechanism, you could create a threshold. So you could say, listen, every party gets a certain minimum amount. And then larger parties that do kick in on the proportional side then get allocations above that amount. But without getting into, we're not specialists in the way these formulas should work. We've observed the way the formula is working in South Africa. It seems to be working fairly well. I understand there are strong arguments being made, particularly by smaller parties, to change the formula. We would rather stay out of that debate. It's not our area that we are experts in, and I think that's more of a political discussion about how you want to balance the thing. There could be an argument for creating a minimum threshold. So every party is guaranteed a certain amount. Obviously, going completely in the other direction and just giving everyone equitable allocations would equally create a ludicrous situation where a party with one seat in the National Assembly and a party with 150 seats all get the same amount of money, even though they're vastly different kinds of organizations with very different kinds of cost structures. In terms of the regulation of public funding and whether we can increase the powers of the electoral court, and then there were a couple of honorable self spoke about why we should be creating a new institution. And the chair himself asked about enforceability. Can I just address all those questions together? The core skill you need is a financial oversight skill. So you're basically applying a formula, making allocations to parties, receiving financial reports from parties, scrutinizing those reports, confirming them, getting them audited, publishing them, and then where you see transgressions, implementing penalties. But it's a financial regulatory function that it needs to be performed. This is not the IEC's core business. They do it. From what we can see, they receive these statements from parties and they send them for auditing. They have no real ability to interrogate those statements. So if you look at the IEC's report, they're just publishing the information your parties have given them, which has been audited. They're not exercising, they're not interrogating the numbers and scrutinizing them, and where they're picking up deviations, suspending transfers, or and our view is therefore that the IEC is an imperfect institution to perform this. They've got a very different kind of function This is far more akin to say, well, the Auditor General, the FIC, or another kind of body like that. We feel that given the importance of this area of regulation, I completely get what Honourable Self means in terms of the plethora of institutions, and you know that you're trying to push to rationalise institutions, not grow them. I think there's a very sound basis to set up a specialised regulatory body to deal with this matter, because I can't see it comfortably being attached to the Auditor General. The FIC is, of course, concerned with foreign flows of money. So it's not really geared up for monitoring this kind of thing. In terms of the chair's questions around enforceability and one other member who I've now, I can't see it on my list. The kinds of a body like this in charge of making what are very substantial allocations to parties has two extremely powerful instruments at their disposal, which are independent of anyone else. They can suspend transfers if they believe there's a serious enough transgression, or they could suspend for a period, and they could also disqualify. So you don't receive the transfer at all, ever. Now, that's a very powerful financial mechanism, in addition to all the other mechanisms that may be available. But it has to be exercised impartially and in a body that's free of political influence. And again, I'm not sure you want to push the IEC into playing that kind of function, because it's going to take them then into potentially a very conflictual relationship when they're meant to be running an election. Chair, Honourable Self asked about economic intimidation, and then I think the question of whether the fear that donors will be targeted, and I think he's basically saying, does transparency always work? Are there not instances where, in fact, some donors can legitimately want to stay anonymous? We've looked at this issue of anonymity, and I must say, I mean, there are arguments on both sides, but our view is that there's an overwhelming argument in favor of disclosure. There are some, I get the concern that in some instances donors would rather not be known, but in most instances, a donor that does not want to be known does not want to be known for dubious reasons. And we would urge a push. And it's going to be painful for all parties, but we would urge a push towards full disclosure and transparency. It is the light of day is the surest bringer of justice and the cleaner up of wrongs. So we would push for full transparency. Sorry, Chair, I'm reading through these, and I'm just trying to see which ones I've missed. I've dealt with restricting expenditure, the use of state resources, the formula, loans. Chair, our argument would be to treat loans in the same way that you treat any other private contribution. In other words, because the thing with a loan, it can be a very soft loan. It can have terms of repayment that are so pushed out into the future that it's in effect a donation and a grant. So, and you don't want to be sitting there picking through what's the precise terms of that loan. A loan, in terms of the regulation, should be treated as if it's a donation. So, same disclosures, same limits, same reporting mechanisms must be audited. I think I've covered the questions, Chair. I hope I haven't left any question out, but if I have, you'll pull me up.
Okay, so, I mean, just thinking about this argument, I don't think we should view citizens as, you know, just mouths to feed, as, you know, almost like reduced to their stomachs and such. Rather, I mean, they're human beings that can exercise, and they want to exercise political agency, that want to inform their own body politic, that they want a government that accords with their aspirations, and that delivers also. I don't think that, you know, the desire for bread undermines all of that. And hopefully, you know, we can hope that political parties, that want to support their political parties, that's something that would forward their interests and so on. And that's maybe just a philosophical view.
Chen, just one other thing. The system that Ryan was talking to, we're not proposing cash is given to people. It's a voucher system. So people don't get, they don't get cash. I mean, they at the most they'd be given a token or a piece of paper that enables them to then donate that to the party of their choice. It's akin. It's not. It's not very different from the PR.
What does the party do with that piece of paper?
It's redeemable. So, let's say the regulatory body that you set up issues these vouchers and distributes it to citizens, and citizens then give it to the party of the choice, and the party of their choice then comes and redeems those vouchers back from the institution that issued them.
All right. Yeah. So, carry on. There was any more?
May I just make one point, which is, I mean, I think it arises from Honourable Self's question about the economic intimidation. Well, the term you used is this term of cadre deployment. The point I want to make there is, in thinking about political party funding reform, I think we also do need to cast our lens slightly wider to think about other places where this needs to work in tandem with. The reform of political party funding, I think, needs to work in tandem with the reform of state institutions and how those function. One of the areas in which we've done a lot of work is, and we released a few years ago a report called The Contract State, which shows that over time, from about 2000, the year 2000, South Africa has shifted to a place where most of the work of the state is being outsourced to third parties, which then creates an incentive for people who want to gain access to money in order to be able to fund political parties to also want to gain hold of certain sections of the state, what in current parlance is called capture of certain institutions. And so money flowing into political parties also then has this effect of people wanting to be able to control how money in the state flows, in order to be able to channel money back into political parties. And this question of cadre deployment, I mean, the history of it, of course, is that this is something that is done with very good intentions and initially. Where it comes from is there's a governing party trying to drive through its policy agenda and being blocked by people who are bureaucrats in the state who were appointed in the past by the apartheid government. And in order to get around that, what you need is a way of making sure that you've got political control over administration in the state. And that was a very good intention, but 20 years or 15 years down the line, the outcome of that is that it's a system now that has created other problems. So I think that's what I'm suggesting. If we're thinking about political party reform, it needs to also, I think, speak to other reforms that need to happen simultaneously for the whole system as well, to be able to work successfully.
All right.
You asked us to go this route, so we went this route because we're Democrats. Anybody wants to have any second bat? Mona, anybody else? Anybody else? No, Honorable Mona?
Just a small point I wanted to add on to the question or the point of view put by our colleagues, Honorable Matthijs. The problem is not so much how the calculation is arrived at between proportional and equitable. In other words, how it's done. Although there are two problems. The one is currently in terms of the proportional side. Parties represented in provincial legislatures are taken into account when it comes to the proportional side. But the National Assembly is not taken into account when it comes to calculating the equitable part. So in practice, you'll have two parties in Parliament who do not share 1 cent of the equitable part. The problem is different. The problem is the 90-10 calculation. That's the problem. Not necessarily how the calculation itself is made in terms of distributing, but the discussions regard to the 90-10.
All right. Maybe as you respond, we no doubt that we're very clear that this is not the panacea to all our problems. This is the first step in a long journey. So there will be lots of gaps. But you know your argument that third parties should be treated like political parties. Just thinking about it on my feet now, you said those third parties are those that campaign on behalf of a political party. So you get musicians, as you've seen, campaigning on behalf of political, openly campaigning on party. How do you then classify them, or taxi drivers, or taxi associations? So I'm just raising that. It's good for you guys to bring all these things, but some of them will interrogate them, and when we sit on our own, we might throw some of them out of the window. But the second point that I wanted to make on the enforcement, you see, your argument that the option of suspending funding is a powerful option. I disagree. Because if I know that I'm going to get far more funding from the private sector, friend of mine, why would I worry about getting money from you? So you could suspend that money. And fine, suspend that money, I go next door and go and get that money from my private funder. So, and that's why I was saying that we need to think about this thing. Suspension is not a deterrent, quite honestly. I could do without the money I get from the IEC as punishment, and just go around the corner and get that same or more from somebody else. And I'm raising it so that when we have our discussions, we take all these things into account. So, again, we're talking to South Africans. When you come and talk to us, be able to defend your argument. Otherwise, with no disrespect, we're going to thrash some of them if they're just because you want to say them to us. You have the last bite. That was just comment. I mean, it's really for educating those that come beyond you. But if you want to comment, you can comment. If not, I think Cindy has organized some lunch outside. But before we go for lunch, could I ask the members just to stick around for 1 minute whilst everybody else goes for lunch, if the rest of us could stick around for 1 minute. But you can respond if you so wish to respond, sir.
Chair, just to say quickly on the 90-10, I mean, the one option you could consider is that instead of the 10, the way the 10% is distributed, I think, needs some further consideration. And it could be that the 10% is used to create a minimum amount that each party gets. So it would basically, the larger parties would not participate in that 10%. It's the 90% where they're going to get their benefits. So the 10% basically creates a minimum platform for all parties. On the issue of third parties, Chair, I think the case, you've got a classic case study of the USA where they regulated this area, but they did not deal with third parties, and then they've evolved a very complex political system, which is about channeling funding through third parties. So I would just urge, be mindful of the unintended consequences of not regulating that area. I agree. The issues you've raised, I mean, there's some things that it's very hard to include in the definition. I mean, does that mean, for instance, that the tripartite alliance, COSATU and SACP, cannot receive funding? You know? So there's a whole lot of other difficult issues that would have to be considered. But we're just raising it as an area to be noted.
Thank you very much to the Public Affairs Research Institution. After lunch, it will be my vote count. And can we agree, Honourable Member, that we are back in this room? It's 1:30 now, 2:15. Is that fair enough? 2:15, and our colleagues from my vote counts, we will start with you immediately at 2:15, so we will suspend business until 2:15. And thank you once again to your team, and as with everybody else, as we think about more things, we will write to you to ask you for further clarity. If you think about more things, please write to us. This process continues until November, so it will be an ongoing engagement. Thank you so much to you and your team, and thanks for understanding. Bye. Honourable members, if you can stick around just for 1 minute.